We've got a lot to get through. I don't know how much of it we'll get through today, but let's get started. The beginning, the introduction's kind of lengthy, so just keep your hands up. These folks will pass stuff around while we go. Did you see the headlines that were interesting this week? I got emails from the Middle East, from Joshua Seifert emailed me. I got an email from Singapore. I got emails from England. I got emails from all over the United States. I got emails from a number of you saying, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Have you seen this? Mail Online put this headline. Could this be the biggest find since the Dead Sea Scrolls? 70 metal books found in cave in Jordan could change our view of biblical history. Anybody see any of those headlines? This is the way another one. Ancient books uncovered in Jordan may date to start of Christianity. Or how about this from the BBC? Jordan battles to regain priceless Christian relics. Or could the lead codices prove the major discovery of Christian history? These are the headlines. And what had happened is the media had gotten a hold of the idea. There are these 70 little plates, or booklets, little metal booklets about the size of a credit card. And so these 70 booklets that have diagrams on them, have some mysterious writing on them, this kind of stuff, have been set out. They're in the hands of a Bedouin, one of those Bedouin type people, Bedouins in Israel, and supposedly may date even earlier than the writings of the Apostle Paul. They may date back to just within a decade or so of Christ. And so that's the issue. The 70 tiny books, here's out of one of the news articles, could date back to the first century. Carbon dating tests found that a piece of leather found with the scrolls was over 2,000 years old. So I got some good emails saying, have you seen this? I also got some emails saying, what do you think about this? And it was fascinating to read. I mean, you read these things that say on pages not much bigger than a credit card are images, symbols, and words that appear to refer to the Messiah and possibly even to the crucifixion and resurrection. There's a picture of an old cross, and the cross was shaped like a T, which is the way a Roman cross would be, rather than our representations that have the top piece. A Roman T would be a typical Roman cross, and there was a picture of one with a building behind it that looks like a tomb, and then behind that, a picture of what looks like Jerusalem. And so the symbolism and the words and all, it's got people really writing this up in the media. And that was the big question. Now, meanwhile, evidently these were found in Jordan, but they're now in the possessions of a fella in Israel. And Jordan seems to want them back. That's the Jordan Battles to Regain Priceless Christian Relics article in the BBC. And I don't know how well you can read this out there, but I tried to bring out some of what this article says. These could be the earliest Christian writing in existence, surviving almost 2,000 years in a Jordanian cave. They could just possibly change our understanding of how Jesus was crucified, resurrected, and how Christianity was born. Well, they're not going to change mine. I've already got four really good references to that called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But that's okay. They might have something to say. A group of 70 or so books, codices, each with between 5 and 15 lead pages, leaves, bound by lead rings, was apparently discovered in a remote arid valley in northern Jordan somewhere between 2005 and 2007. Well, that's kind of iffy. Just the lawyer in me just says, well, can't you narrow it down? That wasn't that long ago. Well, that's okay. A flash flood had exposed two niches inside the cave. One of them marked with a menorah or candlestick, the ancient Jewish religious symbol. A Jordanian Bedouin opened these plugs. What he found inside might constitute extremely rare relics of early Christianity. This is certainly the view of the Jordanian government, which claims they were smuggled into Israel by another Bedouin. The Israeli Bedouin who currently holds the books has denied smuggling them out of Jordan and claims they've been in his family for over 100 years. Jordan says it will exert all efforts at every level to get the relics repatriated. The director of Jordan's Department of Antiquities, Zayed al-Sayed, says the books might have been made by followers of Jesus in the few decades immediately following his crucifixion. Well, that's pretty amazing stuff. So I read these articles and I decided to email a couple of friends of mine. So among the friends I emailed was Dr. Weston Fields, who will be speaking in our library on April the 16th. He's the international director of the Dead Sea Scrolls Foundation. He's in South Africa working on a book. And I emailed him and said, Dr. Fields, what do you know about this? Knowing him to be an authority on things like this, and knowing also that he's very close to the Jordanian government, because the Jordanian government holds a number of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So here was his response. Dear Mark, email to me. I was contacted about these lead books about a year and a half ago, but I was very suspicious of it. And I advised the person who contacted me, David Elkington in the UK, he's one of the experts quoted in these newspaper articles, to work through the Jordanians. In the meantime, there was a change in the Department of Antiquities of Jordan. The new director has taken a more aggressive position. The new director, Ziyad al-Sa'ad, that's the man that was just referenced in the BBC article we looked at, talked to me 3 days ago and asked me, on behalf of Prince Hassan and him, to contact Hassam the Bedouin. That's the Israeli Bedouin who has them now. This I was finally able to do yesterday. Attached is the letter I sent Ziyad this morning. I'm still suspicious of the whole thing. I don't know whether Hassam the Bedouin will come and see me in Jerusalem or not. I'll keep you posted. Because today, my friend Weston is in Jerusalem. And then he attached a letter. Now, please understand. At Champion Forest Baptist Church this Sunday morning, or if you're watching this on the internet at some time close to now, you're getting information that's not out in the news media. This is cutting edge time because we're a cutting edge church. Here is the email that I got, the letter that Weston sent to me that he sent to the head of the Jordanian Antiquities Institute, March 30th, 2011. I'm sorry, I blacked out part of it. Not because I don't trust you, but this does go on the internet. Dear Ziyad, earlier today I was able to speak with the Bedouin named Hassan Saida, who lives, quote, between Nazareth and Tiberias in Israel, about his lead books. His mobile number is... And I blacked that out. But it is kind of cool to think if I didn't, one of us or all of us could be calling the Israeli Bedouin who claims to have these things, saying, hi, I'm with Champion Forest Baptist Church, and I'd like to get a little more data if I could. Dear Ziyad. So anyway, we blacked out his mobile number. Now, this is a Bedouin. That means they move all the time. Hence, he lives between Nazareth and Tiberias. It continues. After listening to his repetitive diatribe for nearly a half hour, my impression was not favorable. He shouted the entire time, apparently being one of those people who think to gain credibility by increasing volume. My impression is that he is completely ignorant of what makes an ancient object, especially one with writing on it, of any value whatsoever. He made the following wild and illogical claims. You ready? The books were not found in Jordan. The books were found in Jordan by his father more than 15 years ago. The books were found in Israel. He met with the Department of Antiquities about the books at some time in the past, but we're told they were fake. He met with the Israel Antiquities Authority at some time in the past, but was told the books were fake. He met with people at Hebrew University, but was told the books were fake. The books will soon be in the Israel Museum, where they will bless the whole world. The books don't belong to him. They belong to the whole world. The books don't belong in Jordan, no matter where they originated, because they have Jewish and Christian symbols on them. He had to sell one of his trucks to pay for tests on the books to prove their authenticity or at least age. There's more. He's working only with and through Robert Feather. David Elkington stole one book from him and has not brought it back, even though he signed a paper to that effect, in the presence of Jennifer, his wife, and Elizabeth. I don't know who Elizabeth is. He is going to sue David and expects to get at least $750,000 as a judgment in the UK. Now, I'm thinking he needs a lawyer. And that's my contingent fee. Instead of taking a cut on the $750,000, I'll take one third of those 70 books. We'll have them here at the CFBC. The books are magical and will bless anyone who touches them or in their presence. He loves the books and they are his whole life. He's the only one who knows what the books say. The books have to be Israeli because they have symbols of Jerusalem. Everyone dealing with the books is a liar except Robert Feather and him, and so forth and so on. Now some thoughts about dating, provenance, and value. And he goes on to say reasons that he's very skeptical beyond simply talking to the Bedouin. But this is, to me, a fascinating thing. It shows the public hunger for things related to the Bible. And it shows a hunger, not just for the public, but for me. I mean, I love to read this stuff. And I love getting the skinny from Weston. And I'm sure Weston will talk about it. Weston is supposed to meet with the Bedouin today, if the Bedouin shows up. Weston did tell me he was so suspicious that while he only had this much time in Jerusalem, if the Bedouin's not willing to come all the way down, he's not headed up to meet with him because he doesn't have time. So I don't think a meeting will take place, but who knows? And if it does, you'll be among the first to know. Now, this is something where we've got to make decisions, because what happens when we study the Bible is we have biblical ideas, but we have other issues outside of the Bible that come to bear. We're looking at archaeology this morning. My suggestion to you is, when we study the Bible, we take our faith and our intellectual integrity and put them together for our Bible study. I had an email interchange with a gentleman who got into our stuff off the internet, and he was looking at the argument that I had made for the archaeology meshing perfectly with the Exodus. And he was a smart fella, but he sent me an email, and here's what he told me in the email. He said, first of all, archaeology is not consistent with the Bible, and you should not try to make it consistent. And the reason why is God has purposefully set up archaeology to mislead people so that you are a Christian by faith and not by sight. I wrote him back. I said, I'm sorry. I don't see God playing a big mental game of gotcha. You know, hey, I tricked you, didn't I? Ah, you used your brain, silly you. God made these. And yes, it's a fallen brain, but he is out to renew our mind, Paul says in Romans, not throw it away. And so I think we can take faith and intellectual integrity, bring them together as we study the scriptures. And that's what we want to do. And I tell you this in light of another headline I found interesting last week. Did you see this one? Bart Ehrman wrote this article that was picked up by some internet media. Who wrote the Bible? And why it matters. And Bart Ehrman in this said, apart from the most rabid fundamentalists among us, nearly everyone admits that the Bible might contain errors. A faulty creation story here, a historical mistake there, a contradiction or two in other places. But is it possible the problem is worse than that? And the Bible actually contains lies? And Bart Ehrman says, not only is it possible, it's true. The Bible is full of lies. Now you think, big deal. Who's Bart Ehrman? And who's going to read his stuff? Well, Bart Ehrman teaches freshmen an introduction to the New Testament class, and he has hundreds of them in his class at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill every semester. He is a best-selling author who wrote and has just recently published a book, Forged, Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. This is a man who already had another big seller, Jesus Interrupted, revealing the hidden contradictions in the Bible and why we don't know about them. New York Times bestseller. This guy's a prominent fella. And he writes this as if he's an academician. And he grew up as an evangelical before he became an atheist. And he proselytizes actively, trying to destroy the faith of believers. This guy's a university professor. Now, I was reading about him and I was reading about this, and I came across a website that's been put up by some students who have just felt very challenged by Bart Ehrman's classes. And these students have gone and gotten arguments against Ehrman from other scholars, mostly seminarians, who I would think are pretty competent. That means that they probably know their biblical languages. They've studied, pretty smart people. Ehrman dismisses them. And he says, ha, a bunch of fundamentalists, a bunch of seminarians can't even get a job at UNC. We'd never even hire them, because they're just not academic enough. I'm sitting there thinking, well, UNC, Chapel Hill, nothing personal if you're watching this on the internet and you happen to go to school there, but I mean, it's not like it's Texas Tech or something with really a lot of academic credibility behind it. All I could think about was the lecture that Peter Williams gave in our library series a few weeks ago, which is now, you can access it on the web. We've got it, the video up. Where Peter Williams goes after Bart Ehrman and Bart Ehrman's views by name, with citation, and just blows him out of the water. And Bart Ehrman's response of, oh, he just must be some fundamentalist at a seminary that can't get a job at the University of North Carolina, doesn't work with Peter Williams, since he teaches Hebrew at Cambridge University. And probably has not even heard of the University of North Carolina. But I strongly suspect Bart Ehrman can't be teaching at Cambridge. It's just an interesting world. So what do we do? What's our assessment with these archaeological finds? Well, let the archaeologists and let the scientists and the Weston Fields of the world ferret out what's true and what's not. We'll use our common sense. We'll use our intellectual integrity. And we'll use our faith. And God will bring us to truth. And I'll tell you, with all of the archaeological work I've been reading and all the stuff I've done so far, it's not caused me to lose my faith. It's enhanced my faith. And I hope it might with you as we look through some of this. So that's what I want to do. But before we do, we need to pause, just 5-minute pause for Hebrew class. Little Havanagila, I thought, just kind of spice it up a little bit. Anybody know what that letter is? Aleph. Anybody know? Beit. Gimel. Dalet. Hey. Bav. Zion. Chet. Okay, we got to pause for a moment and go to our little bookmarks. You got your bookmark? I had a bookmark. I got a bookmark. Okay. Here's what we've done with the old bookmarkaroni. Since I made this, that's why we call it a bookmark. Sorry. Okay. And I say I made it. I just had the material. This was made by our wonderful Sandy Shiver. So, Sandy, thank you. With a little help from Steve Taylor. Okay. So, you've got your bookmark. Biblical literacy class, Hebrew alphabet. Here you've got the letter, Aleph. You've got the name, Aleph. Now, these are spelled differently by different people all the time. There's no real spelling on Aleph. Some spell it with a PH, some blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. It's an Aleph. Doesn't really have a sound to it because it just takes a vowel sound. So sometimes it sounds like an A, E, I, O, U. It just changes. Bait. Bait sounds like a B. I never told you this because I didn't want to confuse you. But if they take the dot out of the middle, it sounds like a V, and it's called a vate. But don't worry about it. We'll learn that later. Gimel, that's the G. Dalet, that's the D. Hey, that's the H sound. Vav, that's the V sound. Zion, that's the Z sound. And then we have these. We have chet. And I put the little squiggle marks because I didn't know how to say spit when you say it. So I just, it's kind of like a CH in the sense of Bach, not in the sense of Charlie. Okay, so it's the CH like in Bach or something. Chet. And the next one kind of rhymes with chet. It's Tate. And Tate was originally a snake. And it kind of looks like a snake. See how it's kind of, see the old Tate was kind of more like that, a coiled up snake. And they kind of cut the coil back to there. Now it almost looks kind of like, if I can write on this, a snake in a basket. You know, like the king cobra coming out. Tate. Let's say it all together. Tate. Rhymes with hate. Tate. So we've got hate, Tate. An easy rhyme. And after that, you're going to memorize the yod. The yod. Yeah. Not Yoda. Just yod. Yod it is. It's a fist. Okay? The yod. And it's written up at the top of the line. The fist. Okay? So we have chet, tet, yod. Then we're gonna pick up a couple of letters today. Cough. 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 See, that's the open mouth coughing. That's not what they think of it as, but that's the way I remembered it when I first learned it. Cough. Cough. And you want to say, cover your mouth when you cough. And then you do that. Okay, because that's the cough coming out. Now, here you've got another letter next to it. And that just is to throw you off. For some reason, the Hebrew scholars and scribes decided they would write letters differently if they're at the end of a word sometimes. And so they took the cough, and it's like they took that bottom part of the cough, that just that, you know, if you, this is the cough, they took that bottom part and just straightened it out, kind of. So that if the cough is at the end of the word, it looks almost like the dalet, except the tail's longer. So the only difference between the final cough and the dalet is a dalet is going to be that size, and the final cough is going to be longer. It's got a tail on it. And you never have that problem unless it's at the end of a word anyway. So when you're studying it this week, learn that. Lamed, that's the L. Okay, that's the goofiest letter out there. It's tall, it's lanky, and it's bulky. All I can tell you is it should be our favorite letter in this class because it is the eastern part of Texas. All you got to do is finish out the panhandle, add El Paso, and come on down, and you have Texas. Okay? So, Lamed is East Texas. Okay, you with me? That's the L sound. And last letter for the day is the mem. Mem. Now, mem comes from the old word mayim. It was the Egyptian picture of water. So the old hieroglyphic for mem was actually the waves of the Nile. And so you'd see that. And you can kind of see it in the top part of that M. It's got kind of that little, see, it's still got the waves there at the top. Let me scoot it over. See those waves? Woo! There they are. Now, mem also has a final form. If it's at the end of the letter, it looks almost like a box. They just kind of close it off there. But that's your mem. So now you've got some more letters. So your new letters after chet, the next one is tate. And then we have yod. Then we have cough. With a final cough that has a tail on it because it comes at the tail end of the word. And then we have East Texas, Lamed, okay? And finally, we have the Mem, both in the early form and the final form. Those are your new ones. So, with that, Hebrew class is over. Class dismissed. All right? Enough. Now, we're going to use a couple of those in the lesson today. So now we're on the lesson. You got to wake up, sort of. You can sleep for the next minute if you don't like the Hebrew part of this class. Anybody remember what that letter is that looks like the water? Mem. That's right. So that's an M sound. And then we have the Lamed, which looks like East Texas. Whoa, I got them out there in order. Okay, Lamed, and then the Kaf. And the Kaf at the end of the word will go like that. So now we have our Hebrew word using our three new letters. Mem, Lamed, Kaf. M-L-K. Kind of like Martin Luther King. M-L-K. Melech is the Hebrew. Melech. Melech means king. So Mem, Lamed, Kaf is Hebrew for king. All right? You with me? Now, you may actually know this. Let me tell you why. There is Melech, and then there is another word, Zadok, which, by the way, here, well, let's go to the old bookmark. Let's go over here for a minute. If we were to take, and I know we're through with Hebrew class, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so we take the Mem, depending on how you write it. There's our Mem, okay, and then we want Melech, so we want the L next, right? So we're going to write our L, and our L's got that top tall piece. So you've got the L, M, L, and then we want our Kaf, the final K. And this is king. So the final K goes down like that, the final Kaf. But we're not going to make it a final Kaf. Yeah, we will. We'll just pretend that it wasn't, because I've already written it that way. We're going to add a couple of our old letters. Remember our old Zion? Except it's a Tzadi. We don't have that letter yet. So just pretend you know this letter, okay? Pretend. We're going to put the Tzadi down as a TS because that's what it sounds like. And then we need a Dalet, a D. So we'll do our Dalet. And then we need a final Kaf again. So here's what we have there. We have M, L, K, but that K is also CH. Different people turn it into English. A CH, a K, either one. We can do a K. Melech. And then we have Z, D, K again, or CH. Now, does anybody have a clue what Bible word you're looking at? Melchizedek. Melchizedek's name are two Hebrew names put together, two Hebrew words put together. Melech for king and Tzadik, which means righteousness. So it means the king is righteousness or my king of righteousness. Melech Tzadik. Melchizedek. Now, back to here. So we've got Melech, king. So we've got Melech, Melchizedek, things like that. King David. Melech David. In Hebrew, King David and archaeology is what we want to look at for the next 20 minutes. And that's the meat of this lesson at this point. If you have National Geographic magazine, you might, I mentioned this earlier, the issue that came out in December of 2010 has King David on the cover with his foot on Goliath's head and he's killing Goliath. The title of it is The Search for King David. And you'll find inside a subtitle to this article. And the subtitle reads, Kings of Controversy. Was the kingdom of David and Solomon a glorious empire or just the little cow town? Depends on which archaeologist you ask. And as you read through this, you'll see pitted against one another are different archaeological schools. And so we'll take it, for example, and we'll look at a couple of statements that are in here, and we're going to weigh them. This says, by the way, it's pitting one archaeologist against another, and the archaeologist, one of them is really upset. In no other part of the world does archaeology so closely resemble a contact sport. These people are vicious with each other. The sides really, really go at it because there's a lot at stake here. So here in the contact sport, we have a chance to look at it. There is an old school proposition that's been under assault for more than 25 years. Here's the proposition. That the Bible's depiction of the empire established under David and continued by his son Solomon is accurate. And for the last 25 years, scholars have been aggressively on TV, in classrooms, in textbooks, in articles, in National Geographic. They've been fighting against the idea that the Bible is accurate. They note the following, and if your kids go off to college and they have a professor like Bart Ehrman, they'll make a big deal of the fact that despite decades of searching, archaeologists have found no solid evidence that David or Solomon ever built anything. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't things built at the time of David and Solomon. Okay? But it means that David and Solomon didn't sign it. They don't put that in these articles. The article makes it sound like there's just nothing there. Okay. Now, one of the chief so-called scholars who pushes this stuff is this guy named Israel Finkelstein, who teaches archaeology at Tel Aviv University. He says during David's time, as Finkelstein casts it, Jerusalem was little more than a hill country village. David himself was a raggedy upstart akin to Pancho Villa, and his legion of followers more like 500 people with sticks in their hands, shouting and cursing and spitting. Not the stuff of great armies, of chariots described in the text. And the article says that there are certain places where this debate is raging. The article picks out five of these places. And I'll zoom out before I show you. This is the Bible Quest. These are the places where the fight is raging right now. And in this, one of them, for examples, that we will look at today, is the City of Two Gates. Here's what National Geographic tells you. The Bible cites a Judean border town named Sha'arayim, or City of Two Gates, near the Elah Valley where David battled Goliath. Yosef Garfinkel is excavating ruins there and has found olive pits and pottery he dates to David's time. Finding two gates, he announced he had found Sha'arayim. With only 5% of the site excavated, some remain skeptical. Well, what do we do with this? Here's what the passage says. This is after David's beat Goliath and killed him. It says, the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and they pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'arayim as far as Gath and Ekron. Now that's an innocuous little passage in the Bible. But what do we do with something like that? This doesn't have great theology. It doesn't have, there's just not much to this. But it's one that has caused great consternation among the critics. Let's put it into context. This is a picture of the Valley of Elah. That is, those people are tourists who are standing in the stream bed, which runs with water a few months out of the year during the rainy season. The rocks down in the bottom are the rocks that wash off of the hillside there. This is the stream bed where David selected the stones. This is where the battle between David and Goliath took place. It's not an iffy thing. Scholars are able to say with confidence this is where it is because the passage in the Bible specifies it in the Valley of Elah. Elah is a Hebrew word for the terebinth tree. The Valley of Elah between Azekah and Soko. And that's what this is. And so the Israelites are on that hill and the Philistines are on the other hill. And in the valley in the middle, David picks up his stones and he slays Goliath. Now the question is, where in the midst of all of this is Shaaraim? Because it's never been found. You can go to, in 2006, Carta's Bible Atlas, the Sacred Bridge was put out. This is the crown jewel among scholars when it comes to atlases, because it doesn't just give a picture. It gives all of the citations and all of the footnotes as to how we know that those places are really there. If you look in the back of a lot of Bibles, like our study Bible, it'll have maps. And they tell you where what is, what where is. But they don't tell you how we know it. This tells you how we know it. This is the only atlas I've ever seen where for every picture, there's like pages and pages of data with footnotes. Okay, to support every picture. So if you were to look in here and say, I want to know about David and the battle, it would tell us a couple of things. It would tell us, for example, that the geographical details of the narrative, especially in the Greek version, reflect a firsthand knowledge of the terrain, cites that article. The two armies were facing one another across the valley, the Philistines on the south, Israel on the northern ridge. And it gives the details that are drawn out. Now, if you wanted to know, though, specifically about Shaaraim, you get over here. After the defeat of their heroic protagonist, the Philistines begin their retreat by running west. And as they turned northward to go around Azekah, and he tells you what dig that is, they were on the way to Shaaraim. The Israelites were waiting there, inflicted many casualties on the Philistines. Shaaraim has not been identified, but according to the list of towns in the northern Shephelah district, which has been shown to run clockwise, it comes after Azekah. Somewhere between Azekah and Beth Shemesh is his best idea. So that's what Anson Rainey, who died in February of this year, he was a historical geographer, a professor, brilliant, brilliant man. And that's what he wrote about in the Sacred Bridge. So how do we deal with this? What do we do? Well, Shaaraim itself, does it exist? Is that just a mistake by the Bible? That's what a lot of scholars said. It's a word that's made up of two Hebrew, well, really one Hebrew word, Shaar, which means gate. And if you take and put at the end of a Hebrew noun like that, ayim, that means two. It's a dual form. So Shaaraim literally means, literally, two gates. And that's what the scholars have been all upset about. Because the city of two gates, literally, the skeptic looks at and the cynic looks at and they say, A, the town never existed. They say, B, there wasn't even an Israelite or Judah town in that time period that had two gates. They're able to show it. You look at every ruin. There never was one with two gates. Every town, even the bigger ones like Megiddo, had one gate. Then the cynic will say, anyway, we know David was a warlord, not a king. So Judah wasn't going to have towns. They didn't exist as a society that could have built those towns. They just had those little mountain villages we've talked about before. Nothing with two gates. And then they finally say, and besides, the Bible's written so late, they say, that Israelites wouldn't have even had Hebrew writing back then to make a record that someone could have written about later. And this is what the cynic has to say. And the cynic could say this real well in 2006 and 2007. But guess what happened in 2008? Joseph Garfinkel, who is no evangelical Bible thumper, as they call us. I mean, he doesn't even know that the story of David and Goliath is literally true. He won't even go there. He thinks it's an allegory or something. So he's not just someone with a cause. But he goes out to this dig, to this ruin, in the Valley of Elah, and he starts digging. And they do a 6-week excavation. And they find a number of really interesting things. It's right there between Azekah and Soko along that river, Sha'arayim. And that's where they find the town. Let me show you what his write-up has produced. And he hasn't done his final report. This is just an early article that he's written because word gets out. And he wants people to know what's out there. So here's what we have. This is Kirbet Kiyafa, which is the name of the ruin. He calls it Sha'arayim because he believes that's where the city is to be found. He says this site is located in the western part of the High Shephelah, atop a hill that borders the Elah Valley on the north. Right where Anson Rainey said it should be. Elah Valley, that's where the fight was. So they start doing this dig. And here's what they find. They find Iron Age 2A remains. Now, Iron Age 2A, that's the time of David. They're found on bedrock covered by a thin Hellenistic layer. I'll explain this in a minute. No superimposed Iron Age living floors or walls were found at the site, indicating a single phase of Iron Age settlement lasting for a short period of time, probably not more than 20 years. Now, before I go further, let me explain what they're saying here. When you have an archaeology dig, one of the goals you have to do is get down to what's called bedrock. And that is Israel's not built like Houston, Texas, where you have clay gumbo down as far as you can see and dig and everything. They actually have rock down at the bottom somewhere. And so they can tell you get down to that bedrock and you've gotten down to the very bottom. Nobody built below the bedrock. So you've gotten to the very first layer. And all they have, according to this, is really one layer of occupancy. So there was a time it was occupied, except for just a small little dusting of Hellenistic stuff. The Hellenistic means when Alexander the Great came through. So that's very small. They're able to immediately dismiss that. That's just a few hundred years BC. And they're able to find this occupation. And because it's just one level, they're able to say that this is probably only occupied for around 20 or so years. They can't be that precise, probably, though he is in the article. But somewhere 20, 30, 40 years is all that this site was ever occupied. And it was occupied during the time of King David. Well, what else have they found? When they did this dig, during the two seasons, 600 square meters of an Iron Age 2A city were unearthed in the western part of the site in Area B, where they found a four-chamber gate, casemate city wall, and two buildings. I'm going to explain this in just a second, but read it with me. A unique find here was an ostracon. That's a piece of pottery that was used to write on, with a five-line inscription written in ink. Okay? So they find not only a town that's located in the right place, that's in the exact right time range, and not really any other time range, but in it, they find a four-chamber gate. Here's what the Elah Valley looks like if you're at Sha'arayim or Kiyafa. Here's an aerial view of what they're digging. And you can see the wall that goes around it as a circle. And you can see some of the buildings in the middle. Here's the gate that they're talking about. It's a four-chamber gate because it's got those four rooms. And the doors would have fit on the gate. It also says there's a casemate wall. A casemate wall was a wall that was built where they would build a stone wall like this and a stone wall like this. And between the stone wall, they would build other walls that would make rooms. And it made it a stronger wall, and it also provided for rooms. Bottom line is, this is serious construction. This isn't a bunch of nomads putting together a field. This takes a society to build. It takes a lot of labor to build. This is a 10-year building project. Okay? So if we keep reading about it, look at this. So they find a gate. That's pretty good, huh? And then they undertake a second dig. The expedition undertook additional field work during the first week of November 2008. Guess what they found? A second gate has been identified in the eastern part of the city. Please understand, this is the only site in all of Israel and Judah where they have found a city with two gates. It's the only one. Not only have they found it, but they got olive. Well, first of all, they dated it by looking at pottery, and they dated it to the time of David. And then they got four olive pits that they found that they sent to Oxford for radiocarbon dating. Time of David. So they've got the town right there. Now, in the discussion of this, he's got some pretty neat things to say. I told you they found a second gate, second set of gates. The writing that was on the piece of pottery was written in ink. You know what? It's Hebrew. It's the oldest Hebrew writing we've got now. It's got the word Melech, king, on the fourth line. The Hebrew writing is there. So now you've got the cynic. And the cynic says, you can't believe the Bible here because Shaarayim never existed. That's gone. Then the cynic says, there wasn't a town with two gates. That's laughable. I can't make that argument anymore. Warlords, not kings. No written records. Sorry, I just really had fun doing that. Because it took they have 200,000 tons of rock in that wall. They have some rocks in the gates that are 10 tons apiece. Now, that's not, hey, Johnny, let's go build a fence. I got this rock over here that weighs 20,000 pounds. You get that end, I'll get this end. Richard, we may need you in the middle. This is a society that's very complex. It's got the cynics all upset. So the refuge for Israel Finkelstein is to say, well, it must be the Philistines. He says it must be Philistine. Well, you know the problem with that? Do you know what the Philistines' favorite thing to eat was? Pig. You go to a Philistine dig, you find swine bones all over the place. You go to an Israelite dig, none. Because it wasn't kosher. Shaarayim, they found thousands and thousands of food bones. Cattle, sheep, goat, not one pig bone. It wasn't Philistinian. And the Philistines never built those casemate walls with the houses built right up against the wall, which this one does. There's no way this. And then the writing is not Philistinian either. It's an early Canaanite script, but the words used are specifically Hebrew verbs that are not found in any other language at the time being used as verbs. This is exactly what the Bible says. And yeah, they didn't find it until 2 years ago, and the digs are still going. And in fact, some students of a fellow who will be speaking at our library in May, Jim Hoffmeyer students, will be in the dig this summer. I say that to tell you this. If you ever want to go on one of these digs, let me know, because there are ways you can go on and actually be involved in this if you've got 6 weeks to take off in a summer and a little extra money lying around. Let's bring this home for today. Then we'll come back next week and work on some more. David wrote in Psalm 24, lift up your head, O gates, that the King of glory may come in, Melech. Well, David was a king, but David wasn't interested in those massive gates opening their doors for him. He wanted us to see that we need to open the gates of our hearts and the doors of our lives to the King of glory, the Lord strong and mighty, he calls him in Psalm 24. So this is my challenge to you. There is a King of Kings. He has revealed himself to us. We can read his revelation with confidence in what it has to say. And my urging to you is serve him. Get to know him. Let's study his word. Let's draw close to him. Second point for home, Sha'arayim, an out of the way place mentioned only three times in the Bible, never of theological importance, not known to archaeologists for thousands of years, only recently discovered. But all of us have places like that in our lives. All of us have those little lesser known places that may not be big, that may not make archaeology today, that may not make the newspapers, that may not be smashing importance, that may not be a lead codice that is or is not valid. All of us have quiet individual places before the Lord. And my challenge to you is just to give them to God. And it doesn't have to be written up, and it doesn't have to be famous, and it doesn't have to be theologically deep. But take the little places in your life and give them to God. We're good on giving big decisions to him. Give him the small things as well. Would you pray with me? Lord, thank you so much for that we live in an age where there's this data and information out there that's so nice and enjoyable to read and confirming on who you are. But Lord, it is my prayer that as we confirm truths in the Bible, you will confirm in our heart the truth of your love for us and your compassion to us and your sacrifice on our behalf, so that we will turn around, Lord, and give you all of our places, big and little. We love you, and it's an honor to be your children and fun to study about you. In Jesus' name, amen.